Olivia Stifler was drawn to poetry at an early age, but it was decades before the publication of her debut book in 2013, and that's thanks to the now late poet James Tolan. He described connecting with her subject matter and the emotions in her work, an important part of his own books.
The value of the poems is beyond the content. We both have a real strong desire for those poems to sing and not just to state our cases.
Yeah, you know. Not just about us. There are so many people who have similar experiences they're not able to articulate. This kind of work resonates with them emotionally and gives them a way also to feel.
Find out about this mentorship and their shared belief in the importance of confessional and sometimes difficult poetry as Olivia Stifler reads from Otherwise We Are Safe, and James Tolan discusses his 2013 books, Mass of the Forgotten and New America, Contemporary Literature for a Changing Society, both from Autumn House Press. This is New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Poetry requires a community, people invested in helping each other make their art better. That's a quote from James Tolan, who really lived by those words as a literary mentor and teacher. Though separated by generations and place, he lived in New York City while she resides in Lowcountry, South Carolina. They were both originally from the Midwest, rooted in the heartland, as Olivia Stifler states in one of her working poems. But what they also have in common is their unflinching look at life. After their first books were published, they continued working together over the next 3 years. He edited her second collection, Hiding in Plain Sight, while also working on his own new book called Filched, both published in summer 2017 by Dos Madres, just months after his death in March from cancer at the age of 53. I talked with them in 2014 while they were on a reading tour together and asked Olivia Stifler to tell me the story of how she and James Tolan began working together.
Well, I've told it so many times. I like to hear James's version.
But you're so much more well-practiced than
I was down in Savannah a couple of years ago. A book had come out, and I was giving readings, and someone recommended that I visit a workshop that runs out of there called the Zona Rosa workshops. And I went down and gave a little reading and a talk. And I had a plane to catch, and I wasn't able to see Olivia's poems. She was one of the poets in the group. And I told her that she should send me something. And she looked at me like I was just full of it, right? That I wasn't really going to look at her all. But, you know, she sent me the poems anyways. And we just started working, getting a manuscript of hers together. And it was so good. I sent it to a publisher I had for an early book, and he loved it immediately. I think within a couple of days, he wrote back. He said, well, you sure knew what I like, don't you?
That's great. What first captured you? I mean, what was the poem that got you excited?
It wasn't a particular poem. It was the rush of the poems together, right? Sometimes you can find individual lines or individual poems that reach out and touch you. And I think that's sort of like the pop music sensibility, right? You're looking for the hit song or something. But with Olivia, there was a sensibility that was clear throughout and a facility with language. I mean, she really was able to tie a deep emotional necessity, it seemed, with very well-crafted, precise language. And that's always what appeals to me, right? I want a poem of emotional integrity, but I don't want it to gush. I want it to be contained in some kind of form, in some kind of syntactical shape.
So when did this collaboration start happening?
I think
here?
In June of 2012. I sent him what I thought was my strongest work. I X'd some of them out myself first. I'm like, no, 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 no. And he went to work on that and X'd some more. And also suggested revision. While this is all going on, he's got his own work to do. I'm still writing, continuing to send stuff to him. And it took a year. It was a really fascinating interchange to me. Like, I started learning. Like, he would say, you need to look at the ends of those lines on this one and this. And so I'm starting to think about some things that are not ordinary for me. The language is, I can do better there. But there are technical things that I don't even know. I'm thinking, I need to line up all the ends of these lines really nicely, you know. And I like this order, this beautiful little logic. I'd really like them all to look like a block. And of course, with modern poetry, that's pretty goofy. But that's where I was. So, you know, I'm learning and continue to. And I love that part too. It's like, ooh, I missed that, but now I get it.
Yeah.
And so it's just delightful.
Now, you would think usually the mentor is going to be the older one leading the younger one along the way, but James, you're quite a bit younger than Olivia. And
oh, don't tell how much.
I don't know how much.
Oh,
I don't
good.
Know when your birthday is. So it's really wonderful to see this connection that you two have made. James, you teach in New York City, right? You're
correct.
At
Borough Manhattan Community College.
So how did you find time to add one more loose poet to the...
Well put.
She's a quick study. You know, she gives me a lot more credit than I probably deserve, right? I mean, the poems were wonderfully good, and I would read them, and it would be clear to me that there were certain things that she wasn't thinking about, that all she had to do was be pointed in that direction. She pretty much fixed them herself. And I don't mean to disparage my students, but you teach a poetry workshop at a community college. It's not always high-level work that you're getting, right? So to have somebody who was glad to put the effort in to keep on working on the poems, it was just beautiful to see them keep on getting better and better, and they're already good to start with.
Yeah, you know, that's exciting, isn't it, to watch it develop? When you first started writing poetry, Olivia, did you find that you were writing about your mother? How did it begin for you?
The first poem I really wanted to write was the second poem in the book called A Question of Seasons. My mother had just died about a year before I began writing, and it was still fresh and painful. It was so important to me to write that poem, and I struggled and struggled and worked and worked. I think it took me 2 months to find one word that I needed, but I was desperate to write that poem. It was almost like after I wrote it, then the door started opening farther and farther. I was driven to write that one.
I'm going to have you read that.
All right. A Question of Seasons. We sit side by side on the sofa. I thought we would grow old together, I say. So did I, my mother replies. So did I. When? I ask because I'm sure she knows. In the spring, she says. We no longer shepherd our words. That was for yesterday. So full of tomorrows, we could afford to jockey lies. Time has turned on us. It slides like hourglass sand through the mouth of a slick funnel. Behind thick glasses, her near-blind eyes search the perimeter, then draw a bead on wallpaper birds. But when she fires, what if there is nothing else? I am the one gut shot. It is the 11th hour, and I fall hard into her Gethsemane. My tongue teetering like a seesaw between a symphony of lies and the chorus of my disbelief. Words hide. Time hangs a noose above my head. To avoid being her Judas, I would bargain with anybody's devil from anybody's hell. Cushioned in her stillness, she waits for my answer, and the words I finally blurt prick like a splinter nagging flesh. If there is nothing, you won't know. Looking straight ahead, she leans forward and reaches for her rolling legs. I think I'll rest a while. We inch down the darkening hallway, silence gathering on us like dust, toward her rumpled home hospital bed. Outside, on the birdhouse roofs, the last clumps of winter-weary snow are melting into teardrops.
A Question of Seasons, that's the second poem in the collection by Olivia Stifler called Otherwise We Are Safe, and this is New Letters on the Air. You were driven to write this, but why a poem?
I always wanted to be a poet. That was my real ambition in life. I didn't have another one. Then I got sidetracked completely because I married young, I had a child, I needed to make a living, and poets are not exactly adept at that. And and I dropped out of school. I couldn't do school. I was working. So, you know, I'm supporting a family, and I did that for many, many, many years. When I retired and moved, I lived in a little fairly isolated community outside of Savannah. That was the first place we moved in the South. And I had time. I didn't have anything else I had to do. Pass the dishes, you know, and the dishwasher pretty much took care of those. So I really had time to focus. And I had found this writers group. And a woman that I met, a poet from Atlanta named Ann Webster, really started pushing me. She was like a model for me. She published her first book at 67, and it was a fabulous book. So I really started working, and I loved it.
Yeah. Well, James, did someone do this for you? Somebody that you could bounce things off of early on that helped you go along your way?
There was a professor at the college where I went called Lucian Strike, who was well known. He did some Heartland anthologies of Midwestern poetry. And I was just in the class to try to get a college credit. I had had some corny love poems that I had written, and I thought I could get a quick 3 credits out of them. And he wasn't having it.
So you know well how students think.
Yes. But the anthology was huge because there were poets in there who were writing in a diction in a language familiar to me. It didn't seem like high inflated diction. It didn't seem like the language of a class that I could not aspire to. It seemed that there were people from all kinds of backgrounds in the Midwest, speaking as Midwesterners, writing a poetry that I really took to. That sort of engagement was tremendous to me. And he actually would look at something I made and help me make it better. And I mean, that's the root of poetry, right? We're makers, right? And he gave me some indication that what I was making mattered and that we were going to work on it together and make it better. It was funny because as a high school student, I edited the student newspaper. So I thought I was going to be a journalist. That didn't pan out, and I drifted for a while before I finished my degree. So I only took this course, and I started writing. It just was a tumble-down effect. I mean, I had a lot of time because I was living in squalid circumstances, and I was just reading and writing constantly. I don't think I was ever happier or kinder to other people than when I was doing that. So it seemed clearly that there was a call there. In many cultures, poetry is considered a calling, and it felt like that to me.
Mae Sarton has something to say about that. The novelist chooses that profession, but a poet is chosen. There's that sense of vocation. I got to. I need to.
Yeah. James, the opening poem to Mass of the Forgotten, it's from your earlier chapbook, Red Walls. Talk a little bit about that poem and what you're doing in there. There's a lot of repetition.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about the form you're using.
Well, I guess for me, form is always a method of containment, right? And the form has to operate in such a way to contain whatever energy you're trying to bring across in the poem. And that's a relatively early poem for me. And I think for a lot of that book, what I was trying to do was reconstitute memory. You know, there was a lot of trauma that happened early in my life that I had buried away and trying to find some way to bring that out again without feeling overwhelmed by it. Before I could write about it directly, I wrote about it archetypally, and then writing about it archetypally, the refrain in there gave me some way to kind of catch a breath and also locate myself. You know, I think sometimes the life you have is given, and sometimes the life you have is chosen, and I think I was working to try to use where I come from as a way to choose my beginnings again.
Let's have you read Red Walls, because I thought it would be fun to listen to.
Red Walls. Where I come from, we take bricks, one by one. We take them red and muddied from the earth. Where I come from, we take bricks from the earth. We take them one by one. Where I come from, masons worked, ground grew up, ate what they left behind. Where I come from, bricks got swallowed, and it's our job to loose them from the soil. Where I come from, each takes his bricks and builds a wall to protect what we've been given, to make special those we invite in. Where I come from, the odor of one city mixes with others on the wind that finds its way. Where I come from, a wolf blows hot against the walls all day, and bricks are how we build a home. Where I come from, hunches grow from safe places in the soil, and a soul builds walls to protect what must not die. Where I come from, walls are a kind of flesh, and it's a blessing to be invited in. Where I come from is red bricks from here.
James Toland's poem Red Walls, which opens the book Mass of the Forgotten, and you're listening to New Letters on the Air. It's interesting, too, looking at it on the page, even though it doesn't have the even endings on the right side that you were talking about, Olivia. Each stanza is like a little brick. It's so satisfying, especially to hear it. I love the repetition. There's something that feeds the soul. Well, you know, in reading both of your books back to back, I can see where you're simpatico. You both had challenging childhoods that has created a well that you've drawn from, even though your stories are very different. James, I thought I would have you read one of the poems in this book that's also included in the anthology New America, Contemporary Literature for a Changing Society, which you co-edited with Holly Messett. It's called The Purple Crayon.
I find a jumbo Crayola in the new used couch, purple, like an herald in the purple crayon. The children's book I once believed was named after my dad. And I'm 16 again, driving him home one more last time from the bar at Ted's Log Cabin, where he's been since lunch. Closing in again on the indoor martini record, double digits, no big thing. When stopped at the corner of Lewis and Grand, he flings open his door and lets loose all over the road. No usual drunken puking. This one's laced with bloody coagulum, olives, bifocals, and false teeth. I throw the two-tone Dodge into park, fish his specs and teeth out of the mess, and drive him to St. Therese, and 2 weeks in detox before the next new lifetime of high. I'm Hal T, and I'm my dad's story in a crayon. A lie I've been telling for almost 20 years. My mother was driving. It was one of the few times she wouldn't go get him by herself. She is the one who dipped into what his body emptied to rescue the only help he'd ever admitted needing. She who drove him to the hospital, who stayed with him despite all those drunken years, who loved him more than I have ever known how to love. I'm 32 and still want to be the hero. Want to be the one reaching into the wretch, the one making the necessary gesture. Not the pimpled boy in the back seat, mouth hung wide, unable or unprepared to act. Hamlet, still considering the ghost. I loved my father and did nothing. Sat there, hating myself for loving this chance to see what I'd been hiding and holding inside all those years.
That's The Purple Crayon from the collection Mass of the Forgotten by James Toland, who also included it in the anthology called New America, Contemporary Literature for a Changing Society, which you edited with Holly Messett. Tell me a little bit about that anthology, because it has not only poetry, but it has short stories, plays.
Right.
But what was the drive to assemble this book?
I think the aggravation of how slow change happens in the academy, right? And we've been talking about multiculturalism and diversity for more than a generation now. But every time I see literature books or anthologies, they tend to still have this white canonical structure followed by a little add-on of color and difference at the end as a kind of tokenism. And Holly and I really wanted to take a chance to put together an anthology that was built around diversity without foregrounding that. That America was a land of diversity. It wasn't going to be ghettoized into African-American literature and Asian-American literature, but all these different kinds of diversity really fed what we meant by the literature we live in. What's been heartening is that so many of the people that are in that anthology who are important names in contemporary literature have done so much work for it. I mean, Junot Diaz gave us that story that's in there for next to nothing. And as soon as we got him, it made it more attractive for everybody else. Dino Mengestu read at the book launch right after he won the MacArthur Prize. So he certainly didn't have to give us a free reading for the anthology. So the people in the book are doing so much to try to bring attention to it.
But, that's wonderful. Yeah.
And the other thing that we were adding to it, too, is that privilege was sneaking back into many of these anthologies in a kind of normalcy, right? There was a sense that we didn't want to have anything in there that might potentially offend somebody, and we wanted an anthology that might offend some people, right? Not because we were looking to be offensive, but because some things that happen in our life need to be spoken. If they're not spoken in poems and stories and plays, well, where are they going to be spoken?
Yeah, that's true. In reading a lot of the work in your book, Mass of the Forgotten, you've had some difficult experiences. I mean, with alcoholism in your family, sexual abuse in the church. You have a really tough poem in here, in the sacristy, the poem about an experience in the church as you, as a young boy with a priest. But to take it and use language to bring it forward to people, do you ever get that sense that you're bringing forth these stories that will touch other people?
Sometimes you write a poem for yourself, but often those aren't the best poems that you write, right? Sometimes those are the ones you just don't keep. But some poems you're writing, and they come from someplace else, right? And they seem like their intention is from someplace else. I was at a poetry festival in Round Top, Texas, and I read the poem there in a big auditorium space. And this woman got up and left as I was reading the poem. So I thought, you know, that I had bothered her somehow. I bothered her differently than I imagined. She came back to the book table when I was signing books, and she said, "That poem, I just had to go into my car and close the door and scream for a while and then come back in, you know." And then she thanked me for writing it and so forth. And she gave me a bunch of statistics that I didn't carry with me about what had happened and, you know, just...
Had she been abused herself?
It was her brother.
Her brother.
Yeah.
We'll hear that poem now, but I need to warn the listener that this contains an explicit description of a sexual act. There is no profane language, but the imagery is clear and disturbing. The poem will be over in 1 minute and 5 seconds. If you want to tune out, then return. Here's James Tolan.
In the sacristy, while I unclothed the body and the blood, he laid his hand across my mouth, and from behind he pressed me toward the host, loosened my father's too big belt, and took holy oil into his hands before parting me. He said nothing as he eased his finger in, as if anointing there. He had been teaching us how Christ took Thomas into his body so he might too believe. He reached his other hand around, and he softly sang, "I shall see him. I shall see him. I shall see him in his beauty over there. In his likeness I'll behold him, waiting at the portals for me." When I began to groan, he turned me by my hips to him and kneeled as in prayer, draped my robes over him and swallowed when I came, rose and prayed on Christ while I pulled tight the leather of my father's belt.
In the Sacristy by James Tolan from his book Mass of the Forgotten. And this is New Letters on the Air. I was taken with the way that you handled this scene, and it felt religious, and yet this awful thing was going on at the same time. I was amazed at the way you balanced those two things, capturing the feeling of the church and yet this act that's happening that's not part of it, shouldn't be part of it anyway.
I don't want to sound mystical or spiritual, but there's a tradition we engage in, right? And that tradition has all this poetry and music that follow us around. And if I'm just speaking on my own and from myself, that's just ego, and I'm just pushing my will across the page. But I have to hear, for myself at least, I have to hear some kind of music and some kind of sound that the poem is directing me towards. And I have to be able to listen while I'm writing. And if writing isn't an act of listening to whatever is inspiring and pushing those poems along, then they're going to end up being failed poems. So for this one, it was something that I couldn't write about because it was just too particular to me, it felt, until I found a context to write it in where it sort of took off on its own.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I find it curious, and maybe this is part of the reason, James, that you and Olivia have things going on between you, because you have, Olivia, in your book, there are allusions to the Catholic Church, too, to nuns and
very powerful
and the fathers.
Influence.
And yeah.
Yes, some good, some not so good, but overwhelming, really. It's the wallpaper of my life,
yeah.
The Catholic Church back here. And it looms large, at least the way it was for us, with all the Latin ritual. The nuns were very good to me as a child. They were caretakers for me. I have a feeling they knew more than I realized at the time about my own circumstances. And they were very encouraging to me always.
I read that your first experience of knowing what it was like to be a writer was having one of your early teachers, a nun, rewrite something that you had written.
I was just this little kid, and we had to learn to write a paragraph. So I write this paragraph. I have no idea what it was about, but I wrote it, turned it in, and she rewrote it. And I'm like, oh, I wish I could do that. I was so impressed. It was like magic. So I started tweaking my brain that way, you know, just paying attention. And she did this with some regularity for a while, and I started just getting so interested in the process.
So you really wanted to be a writer from early on. It just took you getting past a lot of stuff in your life in order to get there.
Poor choices, you know.
Yeah. We get a real sense of your first marriage being a difficult one, and you get even in your poems.
I didn't know I was doing it. I hadn't thought about it, but that's funny. Yeah. Getting even.
We should have one of those getting even poems, I think. So
you might have one in mind.
First Holy Communion.
This fits in with both of these conversations, actually. Yeah. Let's have you read First Holy Communion.
I am number two in the procession of eight-year-olds in filmy white dresses and net veils marching to the front pew of St. Ambrose, hands folded into steeples, eyes downcast. When Sister Mary Eustace signals with her clicker, we approach the altar, single file, and stick out our tongues at Father Garrity to receive the body of Christ for the first time. Sister has assured us that today is so special, we may ask for anything and it will be granted, but adds, it is best to pray for sainthood. So I do. I ask to be made a saint, though I am pining for a bicycle. Down the aisle I go again, this time in a cloud of bridal white, fingers tight on the stem of a thorny red rose, eyes studying my pumps. I am 19 when I march into the tuxedoed arms of matrimonial hell, the proving ground of a litany of women saints. 32 years later, having failed at holiness and in the throes of divorce, I remember that I could have had a bicycle.
First Holy Communion by Olivia Stifler from her 2013 book, Otherwise We Are Safe, published by Dos Madres, which in summer 2017 released her second book, Hiding in Plain Sight, followed by the collection filched by the late James Tolan, who died in March from cancer. We heard him read from his first book, Mass of the Forgotten, and from his anthology edited with his wife, Holly Messett, called New America, Contemporary Literature for a Changing Society, both published in 2013 by Autumn House Press. For links, visit our website, newletters.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr at New Letters Radio. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Megan Fulkin, Stephanie Hughes, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.